This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another pharmaceutical industry CEO was in the hot seat again in Washington. Heather Bresch, CEO of Mylan Pharmaceuticals, was called to testify in front of the full House Oversight Committee on Government Reform in Congress to answer questions about the dramatic rise in the price of EpiPen in recent years, which has gone up more than 500% in the last decade. The price hike has posed a serious financial challenge for families and school systems across the country.
Well, this really is a life-saving medication, Mark. The number of life-threatening allergies has risen dramatically in children in recent years. There's really no choice. Families have to supply the dose for their children, and the schools need to keep supplies on hand as well. So this has sparked some real outrage. And you know, Mark, it's not just impacting children and their families. Medicare spending on EpiPens has increased 1,100% in recent years. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid and members of Congress, as well as the public, are rightly interested in why such a costly increase for really an old drug.
The CEO recently offered to provide a generic version of EpiPen that will be priced at about half of the going rate. But this latest incident of price gouging has created a real firestorm of protest around the country, and it belies a lack of transparency in the pharmaceutical marketplace. And it's one of the topics our guest is going to speak about today.
Dr. Drew Altman is CEO of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, which has recently released its 2016 Kaiser Health Tracking Poll. Rising costs of healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and higher deductibles and out-of-pocket costs just have consumers all over the country on edge. And he'll be diving into some of these details as he shares this in-depth view of the nation's general mood on health and health policy.
And Lori Robertson stops by. She's the managing editor of FactCheck.org, is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or CHC Radio on Twitter. We love hearing from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Drew Altman in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. While the presidential candidates haggle over healthcare issues in the debate cycle, Donald Trump wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Hillary Clinton wants to improve upon the law. Voters in five states will have another issue to consider: the legalization of marijuana. There are many unanswered questions, and empirical data are scarce. As the DEA has kept marijuana classification as a Schedule I drug, that classification makes research protocols difficult to conduct, and accessing approved plants for research is a challenging task. Voters in five states, California, Arizona, Nevada, Maine, and Massachusetts, will have measures on the ballot on legalizing marijuana for recreational use. Meanwhile, cannabis has been shown to have efficacious effects for people suffering from chronic and debilitating seizure disorders, largely children. British pharmaceutical company GW has been experimenting in cannabis-derived medications for some time and are now in promising late-stage trials on a drug to treat epilepsy. The company is expected to submit a marketing application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. The drug has proven very effective in suppressing the onset of epileptic seizures in certain patients. In the latest trial, both tested doses of Epidiolex were found to have induced a statistically significant improvement in reducing seizures in patients. A number of families in America have turned to cannabis oil producers privately to try and find some way to help manage their children's debilitating epileptic seizures. Kentucky was the only southern state to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, then Governor Stephen Beshear reasoning that it was not only the moral thing to do for his uninsured constituents, it made good business sense for the state. Kentucky's uninsured rate dropped from just under 15% prior to the expansion to about 6% afterwards. Current Governor Matt Bevin is seeking to change the scenario. He has submitted a Medicaid waiver to make it harder for Kentuckians to access Medicaid coverage, and he threatens to cancel the Medicaid expansion entirely if his request is refused by HHS. They recently turned down a similar request from Ohio, which sought to limit Medicaid expansion in that state. HHS will make a decision within a few months. And medical school is undergoing a dramatic transformation at the University of Vermont, becoming the first medical school in the country to entirely phase out classroom lectures by 2022. The move comes several years after some Stanford senior academics challenged medical schools to, quote, flip the classroom, noting that today's learners are coming through the system quite comfortable learning online and through other multiple platforms. The college will, over the next several years, remove all lecture courses, replacing them with videos students watch on their own time. And instead of sitting through lectures, students will meet in an active learning classroom led by faculty members working with their classmates in small groups. Other medical institutions around the country are looking at similar changes to their training paradigm. And putting their money where their mouth is, several benevolent billionaires are offering their support to medical causes and research. Michael Bloomberg is donating $300 million of his fortune to Johns Hopkins University, whose School of Public Health bears his name. And Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his pediatrician wife Priscilla Chan have announced they are donating $3 billion to efforts that will cure, prevent, or manage all illness in their children's lifetime. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Drew Altman, President and CEO of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, a leading nonprofit organization focused on national health issues as well as on the U.S. role in global health policy. Dr. Altman joined the Kaiser Family Foundation in the early 1990s. Prior to joining the foundation, he was the commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Health and Human Services under Governor Kane, where he developed nationally recognized public health programs. Dr. Altman was the director of Health and Human Services at the Pew Charitable Trust and served as vice president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Altman is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Institute of Medicine. He received his BA from Brandeis University, his master's in political science from Brown University, his PhD in political science from MIT, and did his postdoctoral work at Harvard School of Public Health. Drew, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks. It's great to be back. I know you have Mets and Yankees fans in the area, but I'm originally from Boston, so
Red Sox. Go Red Sox. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you were on 3.5 years ago when the Affordable Care Act was just really getting underway, and there was much anticipation about the promise of covering billions of uninsured Americans. And you also then cautioned all of us that the shift in the American health policy would also generate some new trends in health insurance coverage. And based on the Kaiser Family Foundation's recent 2016 employer health benefit survey, it seems that your predictions were right on target. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about what you've called the most important change in the American health system.
Well, I do think that while we've all been focused on the Affordable Care Act because it's such a hot political issue, beneath the radar screen, there has been a quiet revolution in really in what health insurance is in the country, from more comprehensive coverage to less comprehensive and skimpier coverage with higher and higher deductibles. And it's an important change because, as important as the Affordable Care Act is, there are 11 million people in the marketplaces in the ACA, as much attention as they get. There are 150 million people who get their coverage through work, through their employer. That's how most Americans get their health insurance coverage. And so these changes in insurance from more comprehensive coverage to less comprehensive with higher and higher deductibles every year, those changes are affecting actually far more people than the ACA affects.
Well, Drew, the costs for the employers have been rising steadily for decades, certainly in terms of the premiums they're paying on behalf of their employees. And you know, we've seen a trend to become much more creative about how to control and mitigate those costs. And certainly high deductibles is one way to do it, sometimes more positive, right? Rewards for being compliant with your chronic illness med or no co-pays. How are corporations finding other ways to curtail their costs now that coverage is mandated by the ACA? By and large, you know, consumers really kind of are at the mercy of going in and finding out at the point of service what they're going to have to pay out of pocket for that medication or that service.
Well, we're kind of in a funny period. We're in this period when any of us experts will tell you it is a period of historically low increases in healthcare costs and so also premiums for employers, a 3% increase this year in employer health insurance premiums, partly because it's still a slow economic recovery and that affects how often people go to the doctor and go to the hospital. It's that way also because of the increases in cost sharing. It has the same effect. People use less medical care if they can. But the real issue is, you know, try and tell that to the average working person because while the premiums are going up at a historically slow rate, what people actually pay out of pocket is going up four times as fast. So in this year, when premiums went up 3%, deductibles went up 12% over the last 5 years. Deductibles went up about six times faster than people's wages did. And that's actually the real issue. That's how people experience this. It isn't just what's happening with their deductibles. It's that what they pay out of pocket for health care is going up so much faster than their wages are going up, and that gap is the pain factor for people in health care. So two things are true at once. We're in a period of time when health care costs are going up at an historically slow rate, and it doesn't feel that way at all to average people because their costs, what they pay, continue to go up. What they pay out of pocket is going up. You know, as I was saying, insurance slowly changes a little more every year from more to less comprehensive coverage, particularly with higher and higher deductibles.
You know, the Kaiser Family Foundation really has a lens on the consumer experience in these insurance exchanges, and 20 million Americans have gained coverage. You just mentioned that the uninsured rate in America is one of its lowest levels ever, and yet there are challenges ahead, and we're seeing across the country, large insurers are bowing out of the exchange, and as you said, we saw some dramatic rate hikes going on. I just try to put all this stuff together for people. I don't think they fully understand. And there are a lot of variables to go in that. Maybe you can shed some light on this.
Yeah. So, you know, the ACA does a few really big things, and it's done them successfully. One is to expand coverage for the uninsured, about 20 million uninsured people covered. And two is to rewrite the rules in insurance to make them more fair. So, for example, people with a pre-existing medical condition now can get coverage at an affordable cost. And it's done those things very, very successfully. Still, the growing pains, the weak spot, the area to watch are in the so-called ACA marketplaces. Sometimes we call them the exchanges. For context, it's important to remember this isn't the whole healthcare system. There are 11 million people enrolled in the exchanges, in the Obamacare exchanges, and those exchanges are experiencing growing pains. Some of them in many states are working quite well, but others, particularly in rural areas, are not working so well with high premium increases, and in some markets, insurers dropping out. Most recently, Aetna dropped out of some of the marketplaces, and that got a lot of attention. This is entirely because insurers misjudged what the risk pools would be in those marketplaces. They thought they'd get healthier people in their risk pools than they got. They got more sick people, and so they lost money. So this year, this is the critical year when insurers are making adjustments. They're proposing and largely getting accepted by their state regulators. Mm-hmm. The feds don't do this. The states do this. Much higher premium increases. The next year will tell the tale. Does that then stabilize the marketplaces in these areas? It's not most areas in the country. From the media coverage, you get the impression it is. And so they then adjust their premiums or their rates to their actual risk pool, to the sicker people that they have. Over time, what has to happen is they have to get more people into these marketplaces so they have a bigger pool with more healthy people. They're at 11 million. You know, they need to get to 15, 16, 17, 18 million people across the country in these marketplaces for them to be more robust and more stable, for insurers to be comfortable everywhere across the country competing and participating in the marketplaces.
Drew, I'd like to look at another aspect of the health law, and that's the expansion of Medicaid and CHIP and progress over the last few years. The Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured has been keeping an eye on the impact of the Medicaid expansion. You did a two-year analysis of enrollment numbers provided by the CMS Performance Indicator Report. 20 states across the country have not expanded Medicaid, which leaves millions of adults and children at or near the poverty line without coverage at all. How do the Medicaid and CHIP numbers stack up across the country in 2016?
Well, one thing for people to understand is with all the focus, again, on the marketplaces, more uninsured people have been covered by the Medicaid expansion across the country than through the marketplaces. And people who've been covered by the Medicaid expansion are generally very satisfied with that coverage. There are states, mostly red states, where governors and legislatures don't like Obamacare or the president, and two, don't particularly like Medicaid, just because they don't like big public entitlement programs. And so you've got these low-income people who don't have coverage in those states, just short of 3 million people in the non-expansion states. But most of them are in a few big states, Texas, Florida, right. Georgia, North Carolina. So those in particular are states to watch. And my guess is that over time, but it might take a number of election cycles, as this no longer is about the president, and, you know, we may not even any longer call this law Obamacare in a few years, you know, these states will begin to think less ideologically and more practically about Medicaid expansion, particularly because they get such a large infusion of federal funds. The federal government mostly pays for the expansion if they expand Medicaid, but time will tell.
We're speaking today with Dr. Drew Altman, President and CEO of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, a leading nonprofit organization focused on providing nonpartisan information on national health issues, as well as the U.S. role in global health policy. Dr. Altman joined the Kaiser Family Foundation in the early 1990s. Drew, we continue to be in this most contentious political climate in memory. The foundation, though, has been keeping its eye on the many aspects pertaining to American health and health policy. And certainly the presidential election is going to have some significant bearing on the landscape. The 2016 Kaiser Health Tracking Poll has done some in-depth analysis of how the electorate feels about presidential candidates, their potential impact on healthcare. You know, I was remembering we had David Gergen on our show, and he said, you know, the plan, which he was supportive, fundamentally suffers from a lack of bipartisanship. And, you know, he wasn't faulting the president on this, but he was just saying that. And you were saying that there's a hope for a less ideological environment out there. Is it that you think we might get in some fixes a bipartisan solution, which then will lay the basis for more people to be engaged? And also, what else are you hearing as your Kaiser tracking poll looks to the future?
Well, David Gergen, as he often is absolutely correct. I mean, the ACA has not only been an example of polarization and partisan conflict in the country, it may be the poster child of polarization and partisan conflict. And we see that in our monthly tracking poll, where there is an absolutely perfect split on almost any question we ask between Republicans and Democrats on the ACA. I'm absolutely sure at this point that we could throw in a question and ask, will the ACA take us to Mars and solve climate change? And we would get a perfect split between Democrats and Republicans, because it just simply has become symbolic of the differences between Republicans and Democrats on lots of things. Look, this is just isn't an election about issues. It's an election about the perceived qualities of the candidates, and the country's also pretty divided about that. I do think that once we get this election out of the way and see what's what, there'll be a greater opportunity for bipartisan cooperation on the ACA, but I don't think it's going to be easy in the short term to deal with some of the improvements and fixes that need to be made to the ACA. For example, to address some of the issues in the ACA marketplaces in the Congress. And so I think the opportunities for bipartisanship will be still greater on other health issues than they will be on the ACA still for the next several years.
Well, Drew, I'd like to pivot for a moment, if we can, away from the ACA, though there, we could speak for hours on that, and talk about another challenge, which is the healthcare industry has certainly become far more digitized since the passage of the HITECH Act and the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And while most of the nation's hospitals, and really an astonishing percent of practices, rapid progress in just the last couple of years, have switched to electronic health records, we haven't done so well, according to your tracking poll, in getting health consumers to actively engage with their electronic health records. I think recent polls show that more than 60% of Americans have researched a health issue online, leaving to so many people arriving in the practices with the answer to their question already, or so they hope. But when it comes to using the portals, sharing and accessing their own health data, communicating information with their providers electronically, seems like either reluctance or just lack of opportunity. Can you break down some of the poll's findings regarding consumer behavior and interface with them?
Yeah, I think it just shows it's going to take longer than the experts who like electronic medical records so much ever thought it was going to take for this to be widely used by the public. But people are for electronic medical records. They think it's a good thing. They're not making use of online medical information and the ability to access their own medical information themselves in big numbers yet, for different reasons. What they're worried about is privacy. They are worried about confidentiality and privacy. And there's a bigger question of just how this is affecting medical practice and the interaction between physicians and patients. I remember my dad, who was a physician who helped found one of the big Boston teaching hospitals. At the end of his life, he was a patient in one of them. And I said, well, what'd you think of the quality of the care? And he said, how would I know? They, meaning the physicians, never took their faces out of their iPads. And so this also has an effect on just the way in which physicians interact with their patients. And we hear that a lot in our surveys from patients. And we hear so both the upsides, and the downsides. So I think this is not new for experts who've been working on this for a long time, but it is going to take some time for consumers to just be comfortable with it, just like the internet did, and for it to really spread and diffuse and for people to take full advantage.
Just a quick question on pharma cost and sort of the opioid crisis there, maybe two different ends of the spectrum here. But, sort of the greed seems to be quite astounding in what's happening with the pharma cost, the EpiPen issue. And then on the other side of the equation, we have just so many millions of Americans who are being impacted on the opioid issue.
Right.
I'm just wondering, do you see a way, any strategic advice about how the countries might be able to handle both of these crises?
Well, one thing is to focus on it more. I mean, one of the most striking things in our poll is that if you listen to the debate or you just pick up a newspaper, you'd think it's all ACA all the time. But when we look at our polling and we ask the American people what health issues they care about the most, it's never the ACA. It's never even close to being the ACA. It's always these pocketbook issues of rising deductibles and rising drug prices and issues that really affect their families, like the opioid epidemic. And so one way to begin to deal with some of these problems is simply the basic realization that the issues we're most focused on in Washington, and I would also say in the media, are not necessarily the issues that the American people are most focused on, most impacted by, and would like us to spend our time on.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Drew Altman, President and CEO of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. You can learn more about their work by going to kff.org or follow them on Twitter at KaiserFamFound and at Drew Altman. Drew, thank you so much for the great work you continue to do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you both very much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid claimed that Zika affects everyone, not just pregnant women and their babies, because recent research found that it, quote, causes people to go blind. That's false. Temporary vision impairment is a symptom of Zika, but no adults have gone blind because of the virus. In fact, one author of a study cited by Reid's office told us his study did not claim that Zika causes blindness. Some infected mice in the study experienced inflammation in different regions of the eye, but none went blind. Studies have shown that severe vision impairment is a Zika-related birth defect, however. Reid's comments came during a partisan battle in Congress on legislation for emergency funding to combat Zika. The Zika epidemic began in Brazil in May 2015, and the first locally acquired infections in the U.S. were reported in Puerto Rico on December 31st and in Florida on July 29, 2016. Many people who contract Zika have little or no symptoms. Pink eye is one of those symptoms, but infection during pregnancy can cause serious birth defects. A paper published in Cell Reports in September, based on a study of Zika in mice, found that the virus infects specific target cells in the eye, and scientists also found Zika's genetic material in the tears of mice, but none of the mice went blind. Another recent paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine concerned the case of a man in his early 40s whose vision in one eye dropped from 20/40 to 20/60 after contracting Zika. But after treatment, the man's vision returned to 20/40. If left untreated, such a condition can lead to permanent vision loss. We agree with another statement by Reid that, quote, we need more study to understand the effects of Zika. But right now, there's no conclusive research to support Reid's claim that Zika causes blindness in adults. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to the research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, so they might not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode, but they're having significant symptoms that are getting in the way of feeling good. And left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress, in some cases lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class, which combines exercise with mindfulness techniques, might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
And it was a typical kind of hatha yoga that would include physical postures, breathing exercises, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant who had clinical levels of depression. They all had medical clearance from their prenatal care providers, and they would come to classes, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
And the initial signs from this research are really encouraging. So we found that women, on average, were reporting much less.
A larger study with control groups is being planned with the assistance of the National Institute of Mental Health.
women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms, helping them successfully navigate those symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.